swathe of Caribbean islands, really moving to the left. Not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the arena.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, the advances in civil rights. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to piece out where he falls and how come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know,
even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot it, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? How did we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to Black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me, actually, of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother. Yeah. What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that, actually, the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Grenada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
like to ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in pre-Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful, militant evolution. My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the, not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government, a revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
Was legendary activist Angela Davis, world renowned scholar and activist, and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Grenada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, who was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So, why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this? A strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing them as horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. Mm-hmm. And I think they'd begun to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they look to elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing, a sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader, Marcus Garvey, to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda, and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Grenada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Yes. Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
Not naming any names.
Not naming any names, no.
We'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Reagan do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's some discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children. A little bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the UCLA, yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life, and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide, continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world, and quite rightly so when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline. And she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft. You know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle, and along comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I thought Jaladi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're now up to chapter 3 of part 2, and this chapter is talking about how to deal with non-Muslims. And, of course, this is a very, very vast topic. It's never going to be something that we would be able to cover in one or two or a few sessions. But Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli points to some very, very important issues that we need to remember as Muslims. We've spoken about mu'mineen, we've spoken about fasiqeen, and now we were going to talk about those who appear to act as they are Muslims, but in reality, deep inside, they are far from that. They appear to have faith in something, but inside they are something else. You know, and that level of fisq, you know, is indeed a very, very low, dangerous level, which is exactly why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sees a munafiq as an enemy. Humul adu. فَحْذَرْهُمْ, as Surah Al-Munafiqun says, they are the enemies. The munafiqeen are the enemies. So beware of them. Be cautious of them. When you are a mu'min, you need to make sure that you are able to define who a munafiq is. You can pick out who a munafiq is. Do you need to announce who the munafiq is? That's where the difficulty is, because in many, many cases, you know, someone else might not believe you. But that's also why they're called munafiqs, because a hypocrite is easily able to camouflage himself. And, of course, they're basing their behavior on deceit, on lying, on betrayal, on all of these other evil, very, very vile characteristics. Let me read out very quickly some of these verses that describe who the munafiqeen are. يخادعون الله والذين آمنوا وما يخدعون إلا أنفسهم. خدعة, they're deceitful. ومن الناس من يقول آمنا بالله وباليوم الآخر وما هم بمؤمنين. There's some people who say that they believe in Allah and in Judgment Day, but in reality, they are not. اتخذوا أيمانهم جنة. فَصَدُّوا عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. They think that they have used their faith as a safeguard in order for them to be safe from God. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of course, is well aware of that. They're also very scared of death. فَلَمَّا كُتِبَ عَلَيْهِمُ الْقِتَالُ إِذَا فَرِيقٌ مِّنْهُمْ يَخْشَوْنَ النَّاسِ كَخَشْيَةِ اللَّهِ. You know, they're more scared of people than they are scared of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And of course, you know, they try to conform themselves with the enemy as well. So they are saying that they're Muslim, but in reality, they are supporting or they are aligning themselves with the enemy of Islam, with the enemy of your faith.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه. چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book, مفاتیح, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است که فرون دماغ قصاب داره فرون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره. دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام هم اونطوری که این رو گفته دارم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری میگه ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
ذلك بأنهم قالوا للذين كرهوا ما نزل الله سنطيعكم في بعض الأمر. This is a very beautiful ayah, Surah Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, ayah number 26. You know, they hate, pretty much is what the verse is saying, those who hate that which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has brought down to them in the Holy Book, and then they say, well, we're only going to obey you in some of what you have ordered us. You know, so they become selective in what it is that they want to believe in, what it is that they don't want to believe in, based on them mocking the believers. قَالُوا إِنَّا مَعَكُمْ إِنَّمَا نَحْنُ مُسْتَهْزِئُونَ. They mock the believers. Many of these verses about munafiqeen. The Quran is full of these verses warning us, because ultimately nifaq creeps up onto us. أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ النِّفَاقِ. It creeps up onto us. You know, that's why we need to always remember to ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to keep us away from nifaq. You know, Allahumma tahhir qalbi min an-nifaq, as the dua says. You know, we need to remember that our heart needs to be free of any kind of traits of a munafiq. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, thalatha من كن فيه فهو منافق. There are three traits. If you have these three traits, you are a hypocrite. وإن صام وصلى, even if you are praying and fasting. من إذا حدث كذب, when you talk, when you say something, you lie. وإذا وعد أخلف, if you make a promise, if you make an appointment, you don't stick to it. You break your promise. You break the appointment. You know, you say to someone, I'll be there at this time. You don't even turn up. Or I'll promise I'll give it back to you. You don't give it back. إِذَا وَعَدَ. When you give your word, you break it. And how simple is this in today's society, unfortunately? وَإِذَا أُؤْتُمِنَ خَانَ. And if you are entrusted with something, we've already spoken about amana. And when you are entrusted with something, you betray it. This is the three characteristics of a munafiq, of a hypocrite. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade,
like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spy master and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
When it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassin's squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke, these threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain Al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including Al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
This treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of humanity, against humanity, whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The Mujahideen Khawr group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference that drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian Prime Minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US that often claim to be anti-terrorism rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interests to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations. Haiti's President Jovenel Moïse was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital of Port-au-Prince on early Wednesday. Haiti's First Lady was also wounded in the attack and evacuated to a hospital in Miami for treatment. She later accused enemies of sending mercenaries to kill the president and his family to thwart democratic changes in the country. That's why none of the Moïse's guards were injured in the attack. Moreover, Haitian officials have not yet provided a motive for the assassination or explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. Haitian police says they have identified 28 people in connection to the fatal shooting, of which two were U.S. citizens. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. Colombian police have confirmed that four companies were involved in the assassination of the Haitian president. The companies recruited Colombian nationals who traveled to Haiti through the neighboring Dominican Republic. On the other hand, when pressed on reports that two Haitian Americans were involved with the assassination, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki declined to comment. This arouses suspicions about possible U.S. involvement. After all, the U.S. has a track record when it comes to these types of operations. In 2020, two U.S. citizens were arrested in Venezuela. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, accused Washington of plotting to invade his country, overthrow, and assassinate him. Maduro claimed that the invaders were trained and funded by the U.S. and Colombia. Also, there was the infamous Bay of Pigs operation. 50 years ago, a group of some 1,500 Cuban exiles, trained and financed by the CIA, launched an ill-fated invasion of Cuba from the sea in the Bay of Pigs. The plan was to overthrow Fidel Castro and his revolution. Furthermore, the U.S. track record in Haiti speaks volumes in how the U.S. has treated the country. A simple history check reveals the deep U.S. involvement in this tiny island nation. In 1914, the U.S. sent Marines into Haiti. It gained complete control over Haitian finances and the right to intervene in Haiti whenever the U.S. government deemed necessary at the time. The U.S. government also forced the election of a new pro-American president by the Haitian legislature in August 1915. The selection of a president that did not represent the choice of the Haitian populace increased unrest in Haiti. Meanwhile, Haiti has been struggling with a wave of extreme violence, a growing humanitarian crisis, and a worsening coronavirus pandemic, and now the assassination of Moïse has thrown the country into deeper turmoil, as his death leaves a power vacuum.
However, we do know for sure the United States that this solves a lot of problems for the United States regarding its interest in Haiti and their support for Jovenel Moïse and that administration. It was an untenable situation. They had already been supporting him through a very suspect, abolishing of the Constitution. He extended his term. Now he was ruling by decree, and they were about to force on the Haitian people another election and a new constitution under very, you know, circumstances in which the Haitian people didn't want. Clearly, the masses of Haitian people were in the street.
Haitian President Jovenel Moïse's death has led to confusion about who is the legitimate person to lead the country of 11 million people. Claude Joseph, who had resigned as prime minister, took charge of the government and named himself acting president in the hours after the assassination. Ariel Henry, whom Moïse had named prime minister but had not yet taken office, also claims he should be in charge. Furthermore, Joseph Lambert, who leads what remains of the Haitian Senate, joined two others seeking to rule the nation, announced that he was voted provisional president by his fellow senators Friday evening. With tensions high in the capital, crowds of people took to the streets Thursday night, burning cars and demanding justice. Meanwhile, the COVID-19 pandemic has been worsening in Haiti. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, Haiti was the only country in the Western Hemisphere to not have received a single dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. At the same time, according to the World Bank, the country is facing a dire economic situation. Its economy had shrunk further 3.8% in 2020, with about 60% of the population now living in poverty. Furthermore, according to UNICEF, more than 1.5 million children are currently in urgent need of humanitarian assistance in Haiti.
The United States is directly responsible for the situation, decidedly so. It's intentional to keep Haiti underdeveloped, to keep control of its resources and its labor and its markets under the control of foreign corporations.
With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S. and France, it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve any peace and stability as it goes through this transformation. Moïse's murder has prompted the government to call for U.S. and UN assistance. At this point, the U.S. has said it will only take necessary action to defend Americans and critical infrastructure.
Gun violence is killing more people in the U.S. state of New York than the COVID-19 pandemic. That's according to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He announced on Thursday that he has declared gun violence in New York a disaster emergency, making extra funding and resources available to combat shootings statewide. The first of its kind executive order came at a time when New York City and the country as a whole are struggling to curtail the spike in gun violence. Speaking during an event at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, Cuomo said his plan includes short-term and long-term measures that treat gun violence as a public health crisis. Cuomo said nearly $139 million will be invested in prevention and employment programs to help youth and keep at-risk young people off the streets.
Fact, gun violence discriminates. The way COVID discriminated, gun violence discriminates. When you look among the victims of gun violence nationally, 59% non-white. New York State, 68% non-white. New York City, 77% non-white. Think about that, 77%.
Well, these poor black and Latino neighborhoods and people are likely to be victims because crime is rampant in these communities. But why is crime rampant in these communities? Well, as we see and we know, poverty exacerbates not only just gun violence, but all sorts of violence, petty theft, nonviolent crimes, drugs, gang violence. And these poor black and Latino neighborhoods have been neglected by the government, by New York State, as well as their neighborhoods have been sold out. Gentrification throughout New York City is specifically targeting neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx.
Cuomo also announced he was going to sign legislation that allows for civil lawsuits against gun manufacturers, distributors, and dealers for how they market and sell firearms. The governor added that over the 4th of July weekend, at least 51 people fell victim to gun violence across the U.S. state alone. U.S. President Joe Biden announced last month his plan to fight the rising gun crimes across the country.
Today, the department is announcing, as I just did, a major crackdown on stem the flow of guns used to commit violent crimes. It's zero tolerance for gun dealers who willfully violate key existing laws and regulations. Let me repeat, zero tolerance.
His plan includes allocating more funds to law enforcement agencies to improve their ability to track and disrupt gun trafficking. He's set to meet with the country's law enforcement, local elected officials, and advocates to discuss the plan on Monday. The White House says the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package provides funding not only to the police, but also to programs such as youth employment, which can help reduce crime rates. The Democrats and Republicans are now pointing fingers at each other over soaring gun violence, with the GOPs criticizing Biden's performance in fighting crimes and Democrats blaming their political rivals for blocking their proposals on gun control.
The American obsession with guns at its root is because our founding fathers and the right have just made it part of the American identity, make it seem as if to be American is to own a gun, when being American is so much more than that. It's about working hard and defending your neighbor and, you know, wanting better for yourselves.
An FBI report in March pointed to a 25% increase in the number of homicide cases in 2020 compared to a year before. Figures suggest the rising trend has continued into 2021, fueling concerns that the U.S. could witness one of its highest numbers of homicides it has ever recorded this year.
The Limelight.
It is a tragic paradox that while the Israeli regime settlements are clearly prohibited by international law, the international community has been remarkably reluctant to enforce its own laws, says Juan Cole, writer, in an article published under the heading UN Expert Says Illegal Israeli Regime Settlements Amount to War Crimes. Stay tuned for more. Canadian academic and the UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory occupied by the fake regime of Israel, Michael Link made waves recently. Link asked nations of the world to classify the Israeli regime practice of sponsoring Israeli squatters on Palestinian-owned land on the occupied Palestinian West Bank as a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. The special rapporteur explained, for Israel, the settlements serve two related purposes. One is to guarantee that the occupied territory will remain under Israeli control in perpetuity. The second purpose is to ensure that there will never be a genuine Palestinian state. These are exactly the reasons why the international community agreed to prohibit the practice of settler implantation, when it created the Fourth Geneva Convention in 1949 and the Rome Statute in 1998. He called the Israeli squatters the engine of Israel's 54-year-old occupation, the longest in the modern world. The UN High Commission on Human Rights notes that there are now close to 300 settlements in occupied East Al-Quds and the West Bank, with more than 680,000 Israeli settlers. Link pointed out that the illegality of the Israeli squatter settlements is the most settled issue in the international law. The UNHCR concurs that their illegality has been confirmed by the United Nations Security Council, the Geneva Assembly, the Human Rights Council, the International Court of Justice, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and the high contracting parties to the Fourth Geneva Convention, among many other local and international governing bodies. Actually, you could just have listed the UN Security Council, since its decisions have the force of law internationally. The UNSC has branded Israeli squatter settlements illegal in a host of resolutions. The Israeli regime is alone in disputing this international consensus, but then prisons are full of convicted bank robbers who proclaim their innocence. He added, "It is a tragic paradox that while the Israeli settlements are clearly prohibited by international law, the international community has been remarkably reluctant to enforce its own laws." In December 2016, the UN Security Council reiterated its long-standing demand in Resolution 2334 that the Zionist regime must immediately and completely cease all settlement activities. Yet, since early 2017, the UN Special Coordinator for the West Asia region peace process has reported to the Security Council on 18 consecutive occasions that the Zionist regime has taken no steps to comply with its obligations under Resolution 2334. The UNHCR summarized the Special Rapporteur's call for practical action. In his report, the Special Rapporteur called on the international community to adopt a plan of action. Number one, fully support the work of the Office of the Prosecutor of the ICC as it investigates whether the Israeli settlements violate the Rome Statute. Number two, call upon the Zionist regime to fully dismantle its settlements. Number three, develop a comprehensive menu of accountability measures to bring the Zionist regime in compliance with international law should it continue to defy the international community. Number four, ensure full accountability of the Zionist regime political, military, and administrative leaders who are responsible for grave breaches of international law in the occupied Palestinian territory. And number five, call upon all UN member states to implement the injunction of the Security Council in 1980, in Resolution 465, not to provide the Zionist regime with any assistance to be used in connection with the settlements. Link concluded, "The time for criticism of the Israeli regime settlements has passed." Former Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said only last week that it is the lack of any international legal accountability which has enabled Israel to ignore successive UN resolutions. A new approach grounded in international law is the only path to a just end to this perpetual occupation. During the Second World War, the Axis aggressors militarily occupied countries, and in some instances, they attempt to colonize the vanquished with their own population. Germany invaded and occupied Poland in 1939. The National Socialists really did not want there to be a Poland, and they had no intention of ever withdrawing, so they started throwing Poles out of their own country and replacing them with ethnic Germans. If they could have, they would just have erased Poland and made it far eastern Germany. Likewise, during the Second World War, Mussolini did not just occupy France's city of Nice and its environs, he annexed it to Italy and intended never to relinquish it. It was to prevent this sort of behavior that the framers of the Fourth Geneva Convention forbade occupiers from transferring their own populations into occupied territories. Even earlier, in 1907, Hague regulations, the occupier is forbidden to introduce substantial changes into the economy and ways of life of an occupied people. Occupation in the international law of war was recognized as legitimate only for a year or so during hostilities. The Zionist regime's occupation of the Palestinians, now over 50 years old, has become illegal. The language forbidding the transfer of population from the occupying state to occupied territory was adopted into Rome Statute, the Charter of the International Criminal Court, established in 2002 at The Hague, which has been signed by 139 countries and fully ratified as national law by 123. The International Criminal Court has begun an investigation of the Zionist regime war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, freedom of thought in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Islam and freedom of thought. The freedom of thought in Islam is not recently emerged. In fact, it was practiced and implemented since the birth of Islam. Islam encourages freedom of thought and denounced oppression and compulsion. It refers to the right of the person to think and to express his own thought. The world we live in, it contains societies with all kinds of beliefs. Muslims living in such a world must be respectful towards all beliefs they come up against, no matter what they may be, and behave forgivingly, justly, and humanely. This responsibility placed on believers is to invite people to the beauty of the religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by means of peace and compassion. Islam is a religion which provides and guarantees freedom of ideas, thought, and life. It has issued commands to prevent and forbid tensions, disputes, slander, and even negative thinking among people. In the same way that it is definitely opposed to terrorism and all acts of violence, it has also forbidden even the slightest ideological pressure to be put on them. Sometimes, you know, this whole concept of freedom of expression and freedom of thought, it is taken to extreme where there are no limits to it. We're not proposing that.